Now that was real kindness, that. Her anecdote left an impression on Sergeant MacDonald. As they walked away from the house after saying goodbye to Mrs. Cornish, he said, "A shame this Mr. Sackville died. He seemed a real gentleman." "It would appear so. But if experience has taught me anything, those who knew the deceased are unlikely to speak ill of him so soon after his passing, especially not to a pair of police officers." From Curry House they were to head back to the village to call on Dr. Harris, but Treddles exclaimed softly, turned around, and rang the doorbell again. Mrs. Cornish opened the door. "Inspector, did you forget something?"
"I did indeed, Mrs. Cornish. I forgot to ask where the Birtles live."
He and MacDonald could easily pay Becky Birtle a visit while they were in the area.
"They live in Yorkshire."
"Yorkshire?"
Young girls in service tended to find work nearby, or they departed for the big cities via connections with family and friends. For Becky Birtle to travel from Yorkshire to a barely-on-the-map village 400 miles away was unusual, to say the least.
"I worked in Yorkshire years ago and knew the Birtles. When Becky was old enough to work, they asked me if I had a place for her. They said they'd feel less worried if someone they trusted kept an eye on her."
"I see. Did you inform Becky that the police would like a word with her?"
"I wrote her parents as soon as I heard, but I don't expect to hear back from them before tomorrow."
"I see."
Treddles collected the Birtles' address from Mrs. Cornish and made a mental note to find someone from the district's constabulary to speak with Becky. Sergeant Holmes had better be uncannily brilliant in his conjectures about these deaths, or at least about Mr. Sackville's, or he and Treddles would both end up looking very silly. Very silly indeed. At Dr. Harris's home, Treddles and MacDonald were pleasantly surprised to find not only Dr. Harris waiting for them, but also Dr. Birch, the physician who had attended Mr. Sackville on the latter's deathbed.
"Dr. Birch, Miss Birch, Mrs. Harris and I play whist together quite often," said Dr. Harris. "So we thought we'd make a party of it today and save you gentlemen a trip to Barton Cross. Your thoughtfulness is most appreciated," said Treddles. "I assume you will wish to speak to Dr. Birch first, since his intelligence is more germane to your case. That will suit us very well."
They were shown into Dr. Harris's study. Dr. Birch was a lively man with a gleam in his eye. He responded to Treddles's questions with quick-to-the-point answers. Yes, his doorbell had rung shortly after 7 that day, and he had to dash off a quick note to the proprietor of the village inn, where there was an elderly traveller waiting for him, in pain and in need of morphine. And since his dog-cart was already hitched, he drove, following Tommy Dunn to Curry House. It really was too bad that young Dunn couldn't tell me anything relevant about Mr. Sackville, except that he couldn't be roused and appeared to be in a bad way, or I'd have been better prepared.
You'd have brought strychnine.
Most likely, if I'd suspected an overdose of chloral, and I would have, if I'd been told about Mr. Sackville's body temperature. That is a telltale symptom of chloral poisoning.
Isn't strychnine a deadly poison in itself?
One of the deadliest. Administered to a healthy person, strychnine would cause fatal muscular convulsions, but that property makes it an effective antidote to chloral. It stimulates the heart's function and stops the slide of decreasing body temperature.
Now, Doctor, do you believe the chloral that killed Mr. Sackville to have been self-administered?
Dr. Harris and I spoke about it, and we saw absolutely no reason why it shouldn't have been so, Dr. Birch answered confidently. The chloral that Dr. Harris prescribed for Mr. Sackville was in the form of grains. It is very difficult to force a man to ingest anything he doesn't wish to, and there were no signs of violence anywhere.
The only explanation that makes sense is that Mr. Sackville miscounted the number of grains and paid for his mistake. The bespectacled Dr. Harris was more deliberate in his demeanour than Dr. Birch, but he confirmed without hesitation that Mr. Sackville's gastric episodes had been ongoing, nothing unusual, and that he had indeed prescribed the chloral for Mr. Sackville's insomnia. "When was the last time you saw Mr. Sackville in a professional capacity?" asked Treddles. "6 weeks ago. He had a persistent cough and was worried that it might turn into pneumonia. It didn't, I presume?" "No. Once the weather turned warmer, the cough cleared." "He didn't consult you about his gastric attacks?" "He mentioned them from time to time, but he was resigned. He'd been suffering from them since he was a young man, and had accepted that they would continue to plague him for as long as he lived."
"I see," said Inspector Treddles.
He was about to ask another question when Dr. Harris said, "His new cook showed far greater interest in his digestion than he did. She came and conferred with me once, on her half-day, no less. Interesting woman. She wanted to cure Mr. Sackville of his tummy aches by modifying his diet to exclude those items that could be proven to irritate his innards. Her plan was to start with one item known to be fine for him to eat, and then add in other items one by one, with at least 48 hours between each addition, so that any single item that set him off could be pinpointed and eliminated right away. Very sound methodology, that. But Mr. Sackville scoffed at her suggestion. He might suffer abdominal turmoil once in a while, but he was still a man who liked a good supper and a proper pudding with every meal. Having so limited a diet for any length of time was unthinkable for him.
So Mrs. Meek attempted to enlist the weight of your professional opinion in persuading Mr. Sackville to change his mind?
Precisely. I commended her for her dedication and initiative. I wish my own cook thought half so much of my digestion. But if I've learned anything in my years of dealing with patients, it's that it is nigh impossible to change a grown man's habits. I told her I'd put in a word with Mr. Sackville the next time I saw him, but I never did see him again.
A shame, said Treddles.
Let me now ask you the same question I posed to Dr. Birch. Do you believe that Mr. Sackville died because he took the wrong number of chloral grains? Dr. Harris took off his spectacles and polished them with a handkerchief. Let me tell you a secret, Inspector. Dr. Birch is a terrible player at whist. He would be hopeless if it weren't for his sister, who is formidable on a green baize table. But as a physician, he is thoroughly observant and exceptionally competent and would have made a successful name for himself in the city if he didn't greatly dislike city life. So if he tells me that there was no sign the chloral got into Mr. Sackville by force or trickery, then I will gladly take his word for it. Treddles sighed inwardly. With every interview, Holmes's first foray onto the public stage looked more likely to be a stumble rather than a triumph. So much for the hope that his genius would carry Treddles to widespread acclaim, thereby bolstering Alice's social standing. On the other hand, Dr. Harris went on, as much as the most obvious explanation seems the most logical and likely, I am uneasy about accepting the theory of miscounted grains of chloral. Treddles sat up straighter.
Oh? Years ago, when I was still a student at medical school, a good friend of mine committed suicide by ingesting chloral. His death left a lasting impression.
The physician donned his glasses again and looked meaningfully at Treddles.
In my own practice, I never dispense vials with more than 8 grains of chloral inside.
Treddles's fingertips tingled, He remembered the vial in Mr. Sackville's nightstand, still with 2 grains of chloral left.
I take it 8 grains do not amount to enough to kill a man.
Precisely. Mr. Sackville's insomnia was sporadic rather than frequent. He sent for a vial a few times a year. If one assumed that he sent for more when he'd run out, then there wouldn't have been enough chloral at Curry House to harm him.
Sergeant MacDonald, who had been largely bent over his notebook, glanced at Treddles, surprise and excitement in his eyes. Treddles felt that same flutter in his stomach.
Is it reasonable to assume that he sent for more only when he ran out?
Reasonable enough, since I could dispatch a vial back within minutes.
But in the end, there was more than enough chloral at Curry House, Treddles pointed out,
doing his best to keep his voice even. Dr. Harris set his hands at the edge of the desk and leaned forward,
which to me suggested 2 possibilities. 1, he had been purposefully accumulating chloral. Keep in mind, though, the last time he had a vial from me was shortly after I saw him 6 weeks ago. Is it not odd, if he planned to kill himself, to wait that 6 weeks? Not to mention he never struck me as a man who had the least desire to die before his time.
Treddles exchanged another look with Sergeant MacDonald.
And the other possibility?
Dr. Harris exhaled and clasped his hands together.
Let's just say that I, for one, was not sorry that Mr. Sherlock Holmes of London took the trouble to write to the coroner.
Treddles's breaths came faster. He had to remind himself that he mustn't get carried away. Not yet.
You made no mention of your unease at the inquest, Doctor.
I was never asked any question except whether I'd prescribed chloral for Mr. Sackville.
Given your misgivings, Dr. Harris, do you believe that it is a coincidence that Mr. Sackville happened to die on a day you were away?
That did give me pause.
Dr. Harris looked down for a moment at his hands.
I haven't told anyone this, but at the inquest, had the letter from Mr. Holmes not been read, I would have said something about my suspicions, even though I was most reluctant to do so.
Of course, I understand that reluctance. It's a small village, and the glare of the public would immediately focus on those closest to Mr. Sackville.
Dr. Harris nodded.
I was both baffled and relieved when Mr. Holmes connected Mr. Sackville's passing with deaths in the wider world, since that would exonerate members of his household.
Would someone who isn't from around here know that you'd be gone that day?
Dr. Harris blinked.
I can't be sure.
But people from the village would know.
They know that I travel to London once a month to meet with old friends from medical school, have dinner together and talk about interesting cases we've come across. They more than I. Afterward, it's usually late enough that I stay overnight and start back early in the morning.
Does it always happen on a fixed day?
Usually it falls in the middle of the month, and I put a note on the church bulletin to that effect. Dr. Birch looks after my patients in my absence as I do in his. But this isn't the sort of place where one expects to hear frantic knocking on the door in the middle of the night. In fact, the unfortunate circumstances surrounding Mr. Sackville's death were the first time Dr. Birch had cause to bestir himself for one of my patients when I was away in London.
They thanked him and walked out of his house.
I see you've something in mind, Inspector, said MacDonald, after taking one look at Treddles. I hope you still have ink in your pen, Sergeant, replied Treddles. We are going back to Curry House.
Mrs. Cornish's brows shot up as she opened the door to Inspector Treddles and Sergeant MacDonald one more time.
Inspector, Sergeant, did you forget something after all?
No, indeed,
Mrs. Cornish. More questions came to mind after we spoke to Dr. Birch and Dr. Harris. Would it be all right for me to take a few minutes of Tommy Dunn's time and a few minutes of yours?
Certainly. Tommy is in the garden, I believe. Should I have him come in?
No, we'll be happy to speak to him in his natural habitat. Mrs. Cornish pointed the policeman in the direction of the walled kitchen garden. Tommy Dunn, digging in a corner of the garden, was surprised, but not alarmed, to see them.
Something I can do for you, Inspector?
Yes, Mr. Dunn. Do you remember what exactly Mrs. Cornish said to you when she came to ask you to fetch Dr. Harris? Tommy Dunn thought for a moment.
She said, "Quick, get on that horse and go get Dr. Harris. Mr. Sackville is badly off. We can't wake him up and I don't think there is much time."
Anything else?
No.
Did she mention Mr. Sackville's temperature?
No.
She came running in her dressing gown and she was out of breath, so I knew something must have happened.
I don't remember if she told me he was really cold. I wouldn't forget.
Did it not occur to you that Dr. Harris wouldn't be home? From what I understand, he posts the date he'd be gone to London on the church notice board.
Can't say I read the church notice board on the regular. It's all about on which days the altar flower ladies meet and what not.
They thanked him, returned to the house, and followed Mrs. Cornish to her office. As they passed before the kitchen, Mrs. Meek stuck her head out, a worried expression on her face.
Everything all right? Inspector Treddles has a few more questions, that's all, answered Mrs. Cornish, if a bit tightly.
As she offered Treddles and MacDonald seats and tea, she didn't seem so much nervous as rattled. Perhaps it had not occurred to her that the matter was serious enough to merit a return visit.
Mrs. Cornish, said Treddles, would you mind recalling for us exactly what you told Tommy Dunn when you tasked him to fetch Dr. Harris?
The housekeeper frowned. Whether in surprise or concentration, Treddles could not tell.
I can't promise I remember what I said word for word, but it would be along the lines of, "Hurry, jump on that horse and go get Dr. Harris. Mr. Sackville is in a bad way. We can't wake him up. He's going cold and there's no time to lose."
You are certain you mentioned his temperature?
Yes.
Treddles felt a glance from MacDonald. Dr. Birch specifically laments that he wasn't told of it, and that was the reason he was ill-prepared to deal with an overdose of chloral. Mrs. Cornish's frown deepened.
It must have slipped Tommy Dunn's mind, then.
You think so?
He's young and not used to handling emergencies. I wouldn't be surprised if his mind went blank after he'd heard that Mr. Sackville was in a bad way. He thought the world of Mr. Sackville.
I see. Now, did it not occur to you that Dr. Harris wouldn't be home? I believe the day and time of his absence is posted on the church bulletin.
Mrs. Cornish sighed.
That's one thing that's nagged at me ever since that day. I did realize it, but not until Tommy Dunn was at least 5 minutes gone. The thing was, Dr. Harris didn't go at his usual time of the month. We're used to him being gone around the middle of the month, but this time he was gone at least a week ahead of his regular day. And it was only after Tommy Dunn was too far to hear me shout that I remembered reading about the change on the notice board the day before on my way to the railway station.
When was the change announced? Did you know?
Must have been after Sunday.
Well, the vicar would have said something from the pulpit.
Thank you, Mrs. Cornish.
Treddles rose and inclined his head.
This time we are truly going, I promise.
"So one of them is lying?" asked Sergeant MacDonald, as they made their way back to the village of Stanwell Moot. They rode on bicycles that they had brought from London.
The bicycles eliminated the need for the local constabulary to provide transportation for Scotland Yard. But more to the point, cycling happened to be an activity Treddles greatly enjoyed, and which was much more difficult to indulge in London. Here in the country, the breeze was fragrant, the sun pleasantly warm, and there were no mobs of pedestrians or speeding carriages to contend with. There were, however, occasional mud puddles to avoid, and Treddles guided his bicycle around one before answering MacDonald.
"I don't think one of them has to be lying. It's quite possible, as Mrs. Cornish said, for a young man unaccustomed to emergencies to not hear everything he's been told. My mother used to say that if she sent me to the shop to get 5 things, she'd be lucky if I returned with 3.
MacDonald reached out a hand and let his fingertips brush the bright green leaves of the hedge.
"So after a whole afternoon of interviews, we've Dr. Harris's suspicions and nothing else.
But that's a very fine set of suspicions."
MacDonald was unconvinced.
"Is that enough to get the coroner's jury to return a verdict other than accidental overdose?"
It was patently not enough.
"Well, we still have a few days left for that."
They were near the village. The hedgerows dropped away and a wide vista opened up. Green fields and shining sea, with the village's church tower rising up to an unblemished sky.
"And if all else fails, we've got ourselves a holiday on the Devon coast."
9. "Charlotte, you bloody fool. I hope Mama never sees this, or it would be off with my head for such blasphemous language, if not already for writing to you behind her back. But my word, you bloody fool! This morning Mama took to her bed and Papa was abroad. I snuck out of the house to Mrs. Wallace's boarding home, hoping to run into you and reassure myself you were still in tolerable circumstances. Needless to say, every single one of my nightmares came true in that woman's parlour. I came home to a letter that Mott had smuggled in for me. He had been calling for my letters at the Charing Cross post office, since I am watched closely. The postmark let me know without a doubt that the letter was posted after you had been evicted, but you said nothing of it. It was full of falsely cheerful observations of life at Mrs. Wallace's. I am drenched in fear, steeped, marinated, macerated in it. I beg you to please tell me what is going on. The truth cannot be worse than the dreadful scenarios barging through my head. Or at least tell me that you are not lying in a ditch somewhere. Though how I am to believe you after all the lies, I do not know. Livia. P.S. Come home, Charlotte. Come home."
Sherlock Holmes's letter had caused a sensation. The tone of coverage suggested a willingness on the part of the newspapers, and most likely, by extension, on the part of the public, to entertain the possibility that Lady Shrewsbury's death had been part of a sinister, larger plan, which ought to have made Livia breathe easier, as she'd rarely crossed paths with Lady Amelia and had never met Mr. Sackville. Had probably made things better for Livia, which explained how she could have slipped out, and discovered the reality of Charlotte's current situation.
"My dearest Livia, my apologies for not having been entirely truthful earlier. I am not lying in a ditch somewhere, and things are not hopeless. Yet. Charlotte."
The eviction from Mrs. Wallace's boarding home cast a long shadow. Charlotte felt marked. Even if her situation were to improve drastically, the danger remained that at any moment she could be recognized, her disguise stripped away, and her scandalous past brought to the fore to condemn her all over again. But to be banished from her place of domicile, as bad as it had been, was not as awful as the possibility that the same might happen to her at her place of employment. Should she ever have a place of employment, that is.
The inside of Miss Oswald's employment agency smelled of ink and overbrewed tea. The place was mentioned by two of the sources Charlotte had studied, not so much in recommending it as begrudgingly admitting its legitimacy. Their distaste, as far as Charlotte could discern, stemmed from the fact that Miss Oswald's aim was less to help other women and more to make a living for herself. Charlotte had no objection to that goal. Moreover, she entertained hopes that Miss Oswald would, one, recognize that Charlotte would be a valuable worker and, two, prove more efficient than the charitable societies and registries for which greater efficacy would not bring more profits, only more work. Squinting behind her thick glasses, Miss Oswald perused the letter of character Charlotte had brought. Behind her, a small window set high on the wall offered a rectangular slice of what passed for clear blue sky in London. Livia lived for days like this, when sunlight wasn't just warm on the skin but seemed to have a soft, blanket-like weight. She would sit outside and turn her face up, the risk of becoming unfashionably tanned be damned, and soak in all the heat and brightness. Charlotte had never told her this, but she had planned to take Livia to the south of France some day, to spend a few weeks or perhaps an entire winter bathing daily in that lemon-coloured sunshine.
"You were a typist for Broadbent Lucas and Sons in Tunbridge," said Miss Oswald, a hint of disbelief in her voice, as she set aside the letter of character.
"Yes, ma'am."
There was nothing amiss with the letter Charlotte had forged, which had been typed on proper stationery. The letterheads had been ordered from a good stationer's, and the signature was masterful, if she did say so herself. Unfortunately, she had hesitated at the expense of acquiring new clothes that would have completed the illusion. The clothes wouldn't be costly in absolute terms. They were meant to make her look like a young woman who must contribute to her own support. But compared to how little money remained to her, every price was dauntingly exorbitant. So she'd come to the interview in her own clothes, a jacket, a blouse, and a skirt, which, while not extravagant, were still of a level of quality and workmanship far exceeding what a typist ought to be able to afford. Were she observing herself, she'd draw the obvious conclusion that there was something incongruous about her, that she might not be the humble position-seeker she claimed to be. Why should Miss Oswald, whose business depended on accurately judging the trustworthiness of the applicants, come to a different verdict?
"And what is the reason you moved to London?"
"My parents are no more, and my aunt asked me to come live with her."
"Where does she live, your aunt?"
"Lambeth, ma'am."
After losing her pound note to the girl beggar, a run-down boarding home in Lambeth was the best Charlotte could do. The district was grey, industrial, and in constant danger of flooding, but safe enough during daylight hours, and an acceptable place for a typist's aunt to live. Except Charlotte wasn't dressed like a typist at all. This was what she would have worn for a day at the reading room of the British Library, and no one there had ever treated her as anything but a lady. Miss Oswald pursed her lips.
"Your typing speed, Miss Morrison?"
45 words a minute. I'm also familiar with Pitman's system of phonemic orthography."
An honest answer. In her former life, she had many, many hours to fill. Learning shorthand was as good a way to pass time as any.
"If there are employers willing to have a female secretary, I'm sure I can handle the demands."
"Indeed," said Miss Oswald coolly. "I shall be astounded if you aren't equal to the task, Miss Morrison. But first I must get in touch with Broadbent Lucas and Sons."
Charlotte sucked in a breath. The reason she'd gone to the trouble to counterfeit a law firm's stationery was so that its authenticity wouldn't be questioned.
"We've had word of a lady journalist masquerading as an applicant," Miss Oswald continued, "trying to dig up dirt on those of us in the business of matching qualified women with reputable employers. I'm not saying that you are she, of course not. But you will understand why I have no wish to unwittingly assist in such muckraking."
"Naturally not.
It will take me 10 days or so to complete the check and to review my openings. You may return Friday of next week to see whether I have found anything appropriate to your background and skills."
If Miss Oswald had heard about such a lady journalist from others in the business, then no doubt she would pass along that she had encountered the very woman, one who dressed too well for an applicant and bore with her a letter of character from Broadbent, Lucas and Sons. Her stomach clenched, Charlotte rose, said her thank you, and left. Inspector Treddles, back at his desk at Scotland Yard, scanned the papers for their coverage of the Sackville case. Speculation was rampant, as much regarding the mysterious Sherlock Holmes as concerning the identity and motives of those dastardly individuals who might have done away with Mr. Sackville, Lady Amelia Drummond, and Lady Shrewsbury. Theories on the deaths were wildly inventive. Everything from dangerous secret societies to the testing of a new untraceable chemical. About Sherlock Holmes, opinions were sharply divided. Some insisted that he was no relation to Miss Olivia Holmes, the young woman who had quarrelled with Lady Shrewsbury the night before the latter died. Holmes was hardly a rare surname. Others pointed out that one was far more likely to find this man by searching more obscure branches of the family tree than among the general public. Didn't it make more sense for a kinsman, however remote, to come to the aid of the beleaguered Olivia Holmes?
"Your post, sir," came Sergeant MacDonald's voice. "Something from Inspector Waller for you."
Before Inspector Treddles left Devonshire, he had sent a cable to Inspector Waller of the West Riding Constabulary, calling in a favour.
"Excellent," he exclaimed, accepting the letter from MacDonald. "Any further response from Lord Sheridan's secretary?"
"Not yet." MacDonald pulled out his watch. "But the next post is only 55 minutes away." He sauntered off. Treddles looked fondly at his retreating form, remembering himself as a bright-eyed young sergeant, eager to learn the tricks of the trade. With a wistful shake of the head, he returned his attention to Inspector Waller's missive.
"Dear Treddles, enclosed, please find a transcript of my interview with Becky Birtle. Constable Small, who came with me, takes excellent shorthand. You may be certain of the accuracy of the document. The girl was a bit of an odd bird, thinks very highly of herself. The parents are all right, solid, salt-of-the-earth sorts. They were befuddled by the whole affair and sought reassurance several times that their daughter wasn't in any trouble. Anyway, glad to render a service. Delighted, in fact. Let me know if there is anything else I can do for you. Waller."
Treddles picked up the transcript. Becky Birtle's version of events didn't accord in every detail with those given by Mrs. Cornish and Mrs. Meek. A good thing, or it would lead him to think she had been tutored in her answers. But all three women's accounts agreed enough that minor disparities could be attributed to the vagaries of human memory. Her description of the 24 hours before also did not differ too much from everyone else's. Household duties, an afternoon spent with the vicar's wife, who organized activities so that girls in service didn't get into trouble on their half-days and Sundays, and a return to Curry House in the evening for supper and bed. She complained about Mrs. Meek's food.
"So bland, but she's a nice woman."
And about being locked in nightly with Jenny Price.
"As if we was chickens in a coop, with weasels prowling outside."
And she'd have had more to say about Mrs. Cornish's strictness, but Inspector Waller moved on from the subject. An exchange toward the end of the interview caught Treddles's eye.
Now, most likely your Mr. Sackville died of an accidental overdose. But since we can't be sure yet, I have to ask you this. Do you know of anyone who might wish him harm?
You mean someone killed him? I knew it. I knew it the moment I heard that letter at the inquest.
I implied nothing of the sort. He could have committed suicide for all we know.
Not him. Not Mr. Sackville. He told me he wanted to live to 120.
He did? When?
Not long ago.
Under what circumstances did he tell you that?
I took a walk one Sunday afternoon, a couple of weeks after I started working at Curry House, and he did the same. We ran into each other right above the cove. I said I was sorry that it happened, but he said not to apologise. He said of course I'd want to have a stroll on a beautiful spring day. Said he looked forward to every spring. More so now that he was older and there wouldn't be as many springs left for him. I told him he was going to live to 100, and he said he much preferred carrying on another 20 years past that.
I see. So you would swear on a Bible that he wouldn't take his own life?
I would, Inspector. I'd swear on a stack of Bibles taller than me.
Then do you know anyone who might have a grudge against him?
I say them what be good and generous always have people who hate them.
Anyone specific?
His brother.
His brother?
Yes.
Have you met his brother?
No, his brother is some high and mighty lordship.
Then how do you know?
Mr. Sackville told me, of course. He said his brother would be happy if he were dead.
Ever since Treddles took on the investigation, he'd been trying to arrange an interview with Lord Sheridan, and the next of kin to Lady Amelia Drummond and Lady Shrewsbury. The ladies' relations flatly refused to have anything to do with the police. Lord Shrewsbury, Lady Shrewsbury's firstborn son and the current baron, went so far as to call Sherlock Holmes a ghoulish, depraved rumour-monger, and characterised Treddles's professional interest as shamelessly intruding on a family's private grief. But after some more back and forth with Lord Sheridan's secretary, Treddles did manage to gain an appointment with the man's employer. The Sheridan's address, unless Treddles was mistaken, placed their dwelling close to Lord Ingram's, though not on the same street. Treddles had never seen Lord Ingram's townhouse, and found himself curious. But first, business. The Sheridan residence was third in a row of townhouses, in white stone and stucco, with wrought iron railings and a small portico above the entrance. A dour-looking footman opened the door and conducted them to a study. The sight of an entire wall of books, as always, was delightful. As for the rest of the room, Treddles was no expert on the furnishing of houses, but even to his relatively untrained eye, the study appeared threadbare, literally so in places. The two padded chairs set against the far wall should have been reupholstered years ago. The curtains, too, looked sorry. The carpet, which had once probably cost a fortune, was now in its most heavily trod areas barely thicker than a tea towel. The footman left to fetch his master. Sergeant MacDonald scooted closer to Treddles.
"Thought I'd be afraid to set me bum down in a place like this. But I never guessed it'd be because I don't dare put any more wear and tear on the chairs."
Treddles answered in a similar whisper.
"It's the price of crops. They've been dropping a good long while. And these old families who depend on the land for their income, well, that income has been dropping too."
"Then why doesn't his lordship sell this house and live someplace smaller and cheaper, so he can at least afford new chairs?"
"Not so simple. The house might be entailed, in which case he can't sell it even if he wants to. Not without first petitioning Parliament or something equally complicated."
"Huh. Fancy that. But now he won't be as poor, not with his dead brother's money coming his way."
The day before, Sergeant MacDonald had paid a visit to Mr. Sackville's solicitors, who had confirmed for him that Mr. Sackville, despite his regular visits to London, had seldom called on his men of business. MacDonald had also obtained a copy of Mr. Sackville's will. There were various odds and ends bequests, but the bulk of his fortune had gone to Lord Sheridan. Which meant that Lord Sheridan, unlike everyone else involved with the case so far, had a motive that passed muster. He needed a great deal of funds, and by getting rid of his brother, he would come into a great deal of funds. Men had killed for much less. The door of the study opened again, and their best suspect walked in. Lord Sheridan, a man of about 70, was short and bald, but his eyes were sharp and his movements spry. He greeted the policemen and bade them to take seats before the big desk. "My secretary tells me you have questions for me concerning my brother's death. We hope you can shed some light onto the circumstances of Mr. Sackville's passing, sir. You have heard of the connection that has been made between his death and those of Lady Amelia Drummond and Lady Shrewsbury? It is one of the leading topics of the day," said Lord Sheridan with distaste. "That and the identity of this meddlesome Sherlock Holmes. Harrington retired from society decades ago. The younger generation does not even know who he was. And now all manners of unfounded speculations circulate and multiply. But no, I cannot help you. My brother and I had not spoken in many years. I'm unfamiliar with what his habits and inclinations had become. Can you give us some knowledge as to why he retired from society?" "No, I cannot." "Cannot? Or will not?" Lord Sheridan spoke with a casual impatience that was surprisingly difficult to decipher. "And is that related to the reason the two of you became estranged?" "You leap to conclusions, Inspector. My brother and I were not close, but I never suggested that we were estranged." This gave Treadles the opening he had been looking for. "My apologies, my lord. My perceptions might have been coloured by having read a statement made by someone in Mr. Sackville's employ that you would be glad if he were to drop dead." Lord Sheridan's expression did not change. "I recommend that you give no credence to such statements, Inspector. I took no delight in Harrington's passing. I was much older than he. At one point I was his guardian, both father and brother. There is no joy to be had at the death of someone I watched growing up. Now, if you have no more questions..." His tone carried more than a hint of sternness. Treadles pressed on. "I do happen to have one more. Forgive me if the question borders on vulgar, my lord. But if I understand correctly, in families such as yours, the eldest son inherits the bulk of the family wealth. Yet the impression I receive seems to be that Mr. Sackville had been the one with the larger fortune." "Your impression is correct. Harrington is my half-brother. His mother brought a great deal of wealth into her marriage. But while tens of thousands of pounds from her dowry were used in shoring up the estate, upon her death, she willed almost all of her remaining assets to Harrington, her only child. So yes, he was wealthier, and his wealth was never bled by the ancestral pile." His recitation of facts was smoother than his avowal that he found no pleasure in his brother's death. But how should Treadles interpret this observation? Was it because Lord Sheridan was not an accomplished liar? Or was it because it in fact distressed him to have lost someone who had once been both brother and son? "Would you happen to know, sir, who would benefit most from Mr. Sackville's will?" "His lawyers have informed me that I stand to inherit his fortune. Did you know that before he died?" Lord Sheridan's expression turned forbidding. He was quick, too quick, perhaps, to realize the thrust of the question.
Of course not. We are finished here, gentlemen. I trust you will see yourselves out.
Not worried about what the law might think of him, is he, Inspector? Asked Sergeant MacDonald as they walked out.
He is a peer. He can only be tried in the House of Lords, and he enjoys privilege from arrest. If I were him, I also wouldn't burden myself too much with what a pair of lowly policemen might think of my statements.
MacDonald scratched his reddish, slightly scraggly beard.
So who do you think is lying, then, about how happy he'd be to see his brother dead? His lordship or the dead man?
Hard to say. Without knowing what had made them grow apart in the first place. That is, provided the girl wasn't making it up out of whole cloth.
Treadles wished now he'd done the questioning himself. So much could be gleaned from face-to-face observation, nuances in tone, changes in expression, and postures of the body added up to a rich symphony of information, as opposed to this thin, tinny tune derived from typed words. To Sergeant MacDonald's surprise, instead of leaving the premises altogether, Treadles led them down to the service entrance and knocked. But his ambush of Lord Sheridan's staff, though successful in one sense, he managed to speak with both the butler and the valet, did not yield any useful information in the end, except in the negative category. His lordship did not leave London in the time period of interest to Inspector Treadles. In fact, he had attended a wedding and a dinner in the 24 hours immediately preceding his brother's death, not to mention went to sleep and woke up in his own bed. This time, when they left the Sheridan house, they walked away and turned onto the street where Lord Ingram lived. It was of a similar arrangement to Lord Sheridan's, a row of elegant townhouses all of the same style and construction, except these houses faced a small park, surrounded by a hedgerow, with swings and a duck pond in its interior. They were approaching Lord Ingram's home when a gleaming brougham drew up by the curb and disgorged a beautiful and stylishly dressed woman. At the same moment, Lord Ingram stepped out of the house. They greeted each other with cool nods. Treadles would have thought the woman was perhaps a neighbour Lord Ingram did not know very well, until his lordship said to the coachman,
"I will need the carriage at 7 tonight."
The woman was Lady Ingram. Treadles did not move in Lord Ingram's circles, nor had Alice ever done so, though her father had been a wealthy industrialist. It had not struck Treadles as particularly odd that Lady Ingram did not accompany her husband on digs or attend his lectures at Burlington House. He'd simply assumed that things were different for the very upper echelons of society, and that she must have been busy with her own duties. That greeting between spouses, however, implied such a vast distance. What Treadles was looking at was not any kind of upper-class stricture against displays of affection, but a resolute lack of affection altogether. Lord and Lady Ingram were two strangers who happened to live under the same roof. This was probably not news to anyone who knew the couple, but Treadles still felt as if he'd witnessed something he ought not to have, an insight into Lord Ingram's marriage that the latter had not chosen to share with him. Embarrassment further pummeled him when he realized that he and MacDonald were too close to turn aside, and that he might put Lord Ingram in a situation of having to introduce a pair of coppers to the lady wife. Lord Ingram spied him.
"Inspector, what an unexpected pleasure."
They shook hands. Treadles, praying his face wasn't as red as he imagined it must be, introduced Sergeant MacDonald to his lordship, who then turned to his wife.
"Lady Ingram, allow me to present two of the Criminal Investigation Department's finest, Inspector Treadles and Sergeant MacDonald."
"A pleasure, I'm sure,"
said Lady Ingram with a fixed smile. I will leave you gentlemen to discuss important affairs. Good day, Inspector. Good day, Sergeant.
Treadles and MacDonald bowed. Lord Ingram inclined his head. When Lady Ingram had disappeared into the house, Lord Ingram asked,
Are you on duty, gentlemen? We are, but we have completed our interview. For now.
Excellent. If you have a moment, I'd like my children to meet you. They are in the park. The children, an elfin girl of about 5 and a sturdy-looking boy maybe a year younger, were busy building what looked to be a miniature tent with small twigs, under the supervision of a nanny. At the sight of their father, they rushed toward him and excitedly told him about their castle. Lord Ingram did the honours. The two policemen and the two Ashburton children shook hands, warmly on both sides, for the children were friendly, curious, and full of pep. Lord Ingram promised his children that he would return and help them with the castle, and then he walked the police officers out of the park.
Any headways in your investigation, Inspector?
Treadles shook his head.
I'm afraid not. A few tantalizing glimmers here and there, but nothing that translates into solid evidence that would persuade any jury in the land.
Lord Ingram looked disappointed, but not surprised.
This was never going to be an easy case. I can't thank you enough, Inspector, for taking it on. For Sherlock Holmes, it's the least I could do, said Treadles, feeling warm and bolstered by Lord Ingram's words. If there's anything I can do to help, please don't hesitate to let me know. There is, in fact.
If Treadles had not run into Lord Ingram, he would have sent round a note very soon.
I'd be most obliged if a discreet inquiry could be made to the cause behind Lord Sheridan and Mr. Sackville's estrangement.
The families of the deceased ladies have categorically refused to be of any help, so Mr. Sackville is our only opening.
Lord Ingram thought for a moment. There is someone I can approach for this purpose.
Thank you, my lord. Treadles had every faith Lord Ingram would see to the matter promptly.
Have you had any news from Holmes, by the way?
Treadles had asked to see the letter to the coroner while he'd been in Devon. While the letter itself was undated, the postmark was 2 days after Holmes's misfortune. Most likely someone close to him had discovered the letter afterward and dispatched it to its intended recipient. But Treadles still held out hope that Holmes might have recovered.
No, I've had no news at all from Holmes, said Lord Ingram.
Then, for the first time in their acquaintance, he asked of Treadles,
And you, Inspector? Have you heard from Holmes?
Treadles shook his head. After he'd taken on the investigation, he had indeed sent a note to Holmes, to the General Post Office, as Lord Ingram once mentioned he had. The letter might as well have been dropped into the Thames for all the response he'd received.
But I planned to carry on and do as much as possible.
In the little time that remained.
I'm most grateful.
Lord Ingram shook Treadles's hand.
And Holmes would be too, if Holmes but knew.
10. Charlotte did know of Inspector Treadles's involvement. She'd received his letter. But sometimes gratitude wasn't enough to get a woman out of bed. She had not packed an umbrella when she left home. Of course not. A parasol was an accessory for a lady. An umbrella, not so. When she'd had a bit of money in reserve, there had been no precipitation. And now that one cloudburst followed another, she could no longer afford any rain gear. Or so she told herself, for an excuse not to go out to be met with further disappointments. All the better options had been taken from her. Had she prowled the city with energy and determination, she'd still have returned footsore and empty-handed. The schools were closed to her,
The professions were closed to her. Just about anything that had a possibility of a satisfying career was closed to her. She could go into domestic service, but her age factored against her. Women who spent their working life in service often started when they were 11 or 12. Someone as old as she should have already worked her way up to the position of a lady's maid or an under-housekeeper. She didn't mind scrubbing pots and pans alongside tweenies, but that didn't mean the person who did the hiring, the housekeeper or the cook, would want her about. Which meant she must lie and pretend to have experience and references. She had read Mrs. Beaton's book of household management from end to end. She knew that turpentine could remove stains from clothing and that spirit of wine was good for cleaning pokers. But domestic service had its own drawbacks. In smaller households, she might be harassed by her employer or other servants. In larger households run with military precision, she was safer from unwanted attention. She might never see her employer except once a year at the servants' ball. But she faced a greater risk that someone might recognize her, leading to her expulsion or to being blackmailed. Was it any wonder she had spent most of the day staring at the ceiling? Why expend the energy and wear out the soles of her boots, just so she could spend the next several years on her knees cleaning out grates, while fearing either the son of the house or a sharp-eyed fellow servant who might have seen her from her pre-scandal days? Much better to stay put. That way she'd at least be less hungry. But when the rain stopped, she left for her daily pilgrimage to the general post office, in the hope that there would be a letter from Livia or Inspector Treddles. She hadn't heard from him again after he embarked on his investigation. Temperatures had dropped. Unlike Livia, Charlotte enjoyed leaden skies and day-long drizzle, even better if they coincided with raw winds that rattled roof tiles, while the last few brown leaves shivered on bare swaying branches. But winter was a pleasure only for those who could afford it, who could sit before a blazing fire, a steaming mug of mulled cider in hand, and watch the storm pelt against window panes, while nibbling on a slice of still-warm plum cake. Winter would not be at all enjoyable for a woman who didn't even possess a winter coat anymore, who had only enough money to last her 2 more weeks in the city, provided nothing untoward happened in the meanwhile. At the end of those 2 weeks, if she hadn't experienced a sudden reversal of fortune, she would need to swallow her pride and go to a man. Besides her father, there were 2 men she could call on. One she didn't want to visit because she wasn't sure whether he would help her. The other gave her pause because he would, and she would rather not need his help if she could at all avoid it. No good choices. But then, what had she expected? Even before she ran away from home, she had reached a point where every choice was unhappy and every decision costly. When summer ended, it would be an eternity before summer returned again. As if to further emphasize how far she'd fallen from grace, it poured anew, forcing her to seek shelter beneath the awning of a printer's shop, so that the rain wouldn't ruin either her hat or the hem of her dress. A long quarter hour to stand in place and stare into a future the unknowns of which were becoming all too grimly clear. The rain lightened and became scarcely damper than mist. Charlotte set out again. She took a different route to the post office these days, since she was coming from a different direction, bypassing the spot held by the mother and daughter beggar and thief team. But whenever she was in the vicinity, she still looked about, not so much afraid of being stolen from again, as fearing the mortification if she were to run into them. The beggars were nowhere in sight, but the man who had waited out the rain across the street from her was 20 feet behind. Was he following her? She hadn't feared for the safety of her person in broad daylight, but now unsavory possibilities bombarded her.
After a minute she looked again, but he was no longer there. Had it been a figment of her imagination? Had the man simply been on his way to his own destination? She turned on to St. Martin's.